Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
There he is, smelling beautiful, as always. And if you're one of our Patreon supporters, this is your extended ad-free version of the show. Thank you to patrons including Raphael, Craig York, James Strangeway, Aaron Everett, Miles Clennell. We've also got Mark R. and Neil Fisher, who increased their pledges or joined for the first time this week.
Wonderful. Welcome.
And all of those are supporting us directly. You can join them and get access to our full-length ad-free show and our Patreon-exclusive weekly sister show, Extra Message, by going to patreon.com/UKTech. And there's another benefit that I haven't really explained much, but we talk for a good 20 to 25 minutes before the main show starts. People in our live stream, and all patrons get access to our live stream, have benefited from this, but this week was quite in depth in terms of our exploration of how I used to exploit my brother and also Ian and I's recommendations for things to watch on Netflix and Amazon Prime if you're into science fiction. All of that is in our pre-show, which goes out as part of the unedited version of the show, as well as live, obviously, as we record it. So just some bonus content that you may not be aware exists, but all of that is available at patreon.com/UKTech. Now, probably not a surprise, we're going to touch on this briefly this week. E-scooters are now legal in the UK. I was writing about this for Bloomberg this week, of course, after the government published the rules that companies must follow if they wish to deploy the electric vehicles on roads. Now, there are caveats. This is not a free-for-all. Firstly, only scooters rented from companies like Bird, Lime, Voi, Tier, Spin, Dot, Wind. They all have, pretty much all of them have four letters in their name. But anyway, that's not a caveat, rather, that's not a prerequisite, but you have to be one of those types of companies in order to roll out legal scooters. If, like me, you own your own scooter, they remain illegal, technically.
Oh,
still.
Great. What a logical piece of lawmaking.
There is logic to that, but we'll come back to that in a moment. The legal update was published basically to enable large-scale trials of e-scooters as a way of helping lockdown ease without basically making everyone have to jump on traditional public transport. It's a bit greener at the point of use as well, and means people can travel around cities while socially distancing. And they were allowed to begin from this weekend, specifically the 4th of July, yesterday at the time of recording. They can last up to 12 months, according to the Department for Transport, which also said it's going to closely monitor the activity, you know, how people use the scooters, as well as public feedback, with a view to fully legalizing scooters, including ones that are privately owned in future. Now, many of the world's biggest scooter companies, such as those mentioned earlier, have all said they're planning on rolling out trials. And I have to say, Ian, actually, I was chatting to a few of the CEOs this week while reporting on all this, and it's amazing. They're having call after call with city officials to try and win them over to let them launch their scooters in their cities, because the cities themselves really, really want the scooters. So there's a real demand and a huge amount of supply, and they're moving really, really quickly and pushing very, very hard individually, all these companies are, to try and make sure that their scooters are the ones that are seen in streets, because they all think they have the best ethics and the best hardware and so on and so forth, and the most experience. So there is definitely a very, very high chance that if you live in one of the bigger cities or large towns in the UK over the next 2 or 3 weeks, you will start seeing these scooters. However, Ian, there are some restrictions. Yes. On the scooters allowed on roads. We now have the final text of what those restrictions are. Firstly, the scooter must not have a seat. That's really, really important. It has to be standing only. It also must not weigh more than 55 kilograms. And crucially, this is something that's very different from other countries. You must hold a form of driver's license in order to rent one. Now, that can be a provisional learner license for a car, which to me makes it feel a little bit even stranger. I don't know what similarities there are other than having to pay attention to roads and perhaps have some knowledge of the highway codes and things like that. But you don't need to have the knowledge to get the license. You literally just send off for one and you get given one.
Then you need to have ability to fill in a form, basically.
And the maximum speed on all of these models will be electronically restricted to 15.5 miles an hour. Now, this is actually a few miles per hour faster than we expected the government to allow. I think we thought it was going to be about 11 or 12. So this is it's faster and they can be heavier than we previously thought they would be. And that latter point actually has drawn some criticism, specifically from the RNIB, the Royal National Institute of Blind People. And its chair, a woman called Eleanor Southwood, said, quote, "It's really clear that even with all the safeguards, we do consider e-scooters to be a real and genuine threat to the ability of blind and partially sighted people to move around independently and safely." And she said the RNIB as well was surprised that the speed limit had been increased from what we all thought it was going to be. John asks in the chat right now, by the way, key point, do you have to wear a helmet with a rented scooter? No, you do not. It is recommended as far as the text goes, but it is not a prerequisite.
It would be unenforceable, that's why, because it is for cycles.
What I find interesting is the controversy over the speed and the weight and the visibility of these scooters, considering that an e-bike would go at a similar speed, be similarly visible, similarly audible, I would say, to people, whether blind, partially sighted or fully sighted or otherwise. And so I kind of feel like, you know, even with my personal bias to one side, I sort of feel like if it follows the same rules as cyclists are supposed to follow, then this should be fine and should work.
But there's no requirement for cyclists to have passed any sort of test or have a driving license.
Well, this is a change to legislation to allow these trials to continue. So that one of the reasons why this is a trial, why there are needs for this to be a rental service rather than just a free-for-all, is partly to gather the evidence and to gather the feedback before making a wholesale change to legislation, which in the UK, some of the actual active in-use today legislation dates back to the early 19th century.
But how does that help them gather any information?
No, you can't just say, we want to trial this and just say, well, we'll ignore the law because we want to trial it. They have to create a framework that doesn't directly contradict the whole law in order to allow a trial before wholesale pushing through an updated bill and actually changing the underlying text of road law.
You're somewhat of a scooter expert in that you've owned several. You're obviously very aware of what is and isn't available. So, for example, the speed thing, is it your experience that most scooters don't exceed 15.5 miles an hour?
Most that are rented do not.
Right, but the ones you can buy?
Oh, yeah, mine goes well over 20.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, so I can sort of see that. I can sort of see the fact that they want to create an infrastructure where there's restrictions. But these things are too hard to legislate for. Like, the police are not going to be stopping people going 20 miles an hour instead of 15. They're not going to notice. It's too hard to tell unless they radar gun you, which I really think would be a terrible waste of everyone's time. Mm. And then said, oh, you're going too quick. Well, you know, there's lots of reasons you might be going quickly. If you were going downhill, presumably the scooter doesn't stop you from going more than that. Does it?
It does.
It does. So it uses the motor to brake the thing so it doesn't go ever over 15 miles an hour.
That's right.
Right, okay, well, that's interesting. I didn't know that. So I can sort of see the point of having them limited. But lots of people already have scooters. Lots of people are already using them. Now, all this does is mean that the police are going to look at them and go, well, that could be a rented scooter. I don't know. I don't care. I'm not interested. So excuse me. So it enables people to use their existing scooters without, in the same way, breaking the law as they were, although they are still technically breaking the law. The whole thing's a mess. I feel like what they should have done was said, here's the deal. You know, scooters sold now will be, if they want to be used in the UK, they must be electrically limited to 15.5 miles an hour, blah, blah, blah. But again, I feel like this is very London specific, right?
Or is it across the country? This is UK-wide, and it wouldn't work because e-scooters themselves are not illegal. They're illegal for use on British on public roads. Sure. So it wouldn't work to sell one that is restricted at the point of purchase, I don't think, because you may be buying one for use on your own land. If you live and work on a farm, having that restriction is just not, it's not really fair. So that is an issue. And you know, you look at what Germany's done. So Germany legalized e-scooters only, it's within the last year. And they had some of the strictest rules that anywhere has imposed on scooters. You know, they were speed limited, but they had even specifics down to the angle that the lights must point in terms of making sure that they were visible at night. They had issues where, you know, every single one had to have a registration plate and a license number, so everything can be tracked. And a lot of it is down to It's down to accountability, because the law says you need insurance. Well, you can't get that if you're a private owner, but if you have insurance because you have rented it from a company that is paying it on your behalf, albeit without you being aware of it necessarily, then that again brings it apparently within the rule of the law. So there are lots and lots of reasons, I think, why these restrictions and things are in place. It's because the law says you have to have a license to use something like this. You have to have insurance. Well, we can do that through the rental company. This is basically how they've fudged it, and that's why these are in place.
I see what you mean, because if they're going to then make them legal, or you know, and include people's own scooters in those, then that law will have to apply to them. So people will have to have insurance. Again, this is not what's true of bikes. So the whole thing just feels completely out of kilter to me. I don't feel like scooters are more dangerous than bikes. That's my main thing.
I don't think you will need insurance when, at such point, this law passes. The need to have the license and a kind of insurance is because they can't change what the law is without changing the law. They're not changing the law here. They have come up with a framework that says, look, this is how we're going to do a trial, but the text of the law says you need a license, so you need one with your name on it. It doesn't have to be relevant to scooters, but you have to have one because the law says you have to. And same with insurance coming from a rental company. It's a need for accountability and tracking and things like that. So I don't think it will be necessary in the end.
Is there any law around bikes?
There are bicycle laws. Yeah, I mean, like you're not allowed to ride a bicycle drunk. But they're different laws because they don't have motors.
Yeah.
They're not propelled.
But some of them do.
Some of them do, but they're still classified as bikes. So it's the same as e-bikes, and that's what they're going for, really. They want scooters, I say they, the companies that make them and rent them, they want scooters to be treated the same as an e-bike, which makes a lot of sense because they have a similar level of visibility, they go similar speeds, they're used for similar purposes. And in that context, no, you don't need a license, but there are still restrictions. Like you can't have 10 pints and get on a bike, cause a crash, and be immune even though you were hammered.
But you kind of can, because you're not immediately. It probably wouldn't happen, but because you're not likely to cause a mass scale incident on a bike if you're drunk. You're going to do what I did, and you're going to slide off it under the London Eye and scuff your knee and badly damage your ankle. But ultimately, there's very unlikely to be any prosecution based on your drunkenness. Would there really?
Yeah. There is a 140-year-old law for being drunk in charge of a pedal bicycle.
Okay, fine. I mean, it stands to reason that people shouldn't be on bikes if they're drunk. But, yeah, at the same time, it's not likely that you would cause an accident on a bike. But, yes, I take the point.
I imagine there'll be plenty of people who disagree with you.
Probably, yeah.
But maybe that's where we should end this, because we're at the end of our knowledge now. But if you want to tell us a thing, send it to our email, and you can use our brand new email address that doesn't cost
$100. Oh, we've got another new email address. Hurrah.
Yeah, because this one doesn't cost £100 a year.
Oh, good.
And it is uktechshow@icloud.com. The Next Web wrote this week that McDonald's in the UK is rolling out EV fast chargers at its restaurants. The UK arm of the fast food chain is reportedly installing hundreds of chargers at its locations around the country after agreeing a partnership with InstaVolt, according to an additional write-up in Independent.
InstaVolt.
InstaVolt, yeah. Sounds like something from Robot Wars, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Mm. Or a very sort of nice way of describing an electric chair.
Also, it's kind of, it's both very good description and very bad description, because I imagine the volts are instant, but it won't charge the car instantly. But I suppose that's, yeah, you know, the volts are instant.
Speed is implicit in the name, isn't it?
It's not true.
Well,
when you get to the fact about how quick it is, you'll find out that it is actually quite quick.
Let's see what else we've got. The Next Web said that while the burger chain hasn't given a specific number of restaurants that will get the chargers, it said the units will be installed in its drive-through locations, and there's about just under 1,000 of those across the UK and Northern Ireland. And the InstaVolt chargers are meant to be the fast ones, which suits, because this is going in drive-throughs, and will give you up to 125 kilowatts of power to your EV while you're delivering the Big Mac to your face, as the blog so eloquently put it. Now, this we talked about this briefly in our Discord with some patrons earlier this week, and John actually replied at the time and said that he charges his McDonald's at a local charging point. Well, he charges his car while he's at the McDonald's, and he says he gets 20 minutes gets him up to 80% of charge. So we eat and charge, he says. And when traveling long distances, it works out better to charge to 80% anyway, because it's better for the battery. So that's good. And there's also precedent from outside of the UK, of course. Luke was one of the people who said in the Netherlands, there is a big branch of roadside hotels and restaurants and things called Van der Valk, which is, I hope I've not mispronounced that, Luke. Apologies if I have. It's got a toucan as a logo, he says. And they made a deal early on with Tesla to put charging stations in their parking spots, so you can charge your car while getting a coffee or lunch or dinner or something. So there is a demand for this. My intrigue is really that it's a McDonald's drive-through, because sort of the whole point of a drive-through is that you drive through it, you don't wait. So if you're actually driving through it and then sitting at the restaurant, then why are you driving through? Otherwise, you're just sitting in a car park. That sounds depressing.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, obviously, there are several use cases for drive-throughs. For most people, it's probably just they don't want to sit in the restaurant and have to order. They just want to press a button, give the order, pick the food up, it's done. They don't want to stand around. They still need to eat the food. And unless they're going somewhere very close, then it makes sense to have them just then sit in the car park and eat their food in their car. I'm very much of the opinion that the more electricity outlets you have for cars, the better, because obviously a lot of the things stopping people from buying electric cars are, oh, I won't be able to get where I'm going, I have to keep stopping to recharge, blah 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 blah. You know, all of that's true, and you know that obviously there are limitations to electric cars. They can only go a certain distance before needing to be recharged, but the more of these places you have, the less of a problem that becomes. You know, you're on your way up the motorway, you know, so you want to stop and have a quick break, because that's very common. And, you know, 20 minutes is probably realistically how long it takes you to get out of the car, get the kids out of the car, go inside, use a loo, maybe buy some snacks for the journey back. And then, you know, so you've already added on an extra, I don't know, certain amount of miles. It obviously depends on the car and the speed of the charger. So it's sort of chipping away at this sort of problem with electric cars, which is there's a range anxiety. So, having them everywhere is a really good idea. So ultimately, I feel like we should have them literally everywhere, and that would be great. So John says in the chat that his battery in his electric car is 40 kilowatt range. As a rule, the Teslas are 100 kilowatts now. I think basically what Tesla did was they went, right, we're just going to put the same battery in every car, kind of. So it's they're largely around 100 kilowatts, would be my understanding. So what you've got is probably, because you can get to 80% of a battery very quickly, the bigger the battery, the more you can put in very quickly. Obviously, there is a limit to that. But, you know, with these fast chargers, that means that you can actually add in a surprising amount of range to a car in 20 minutes. Now, of course, it's not as quick as going to a petrol station and squeezing in 300 or 400 miles worth of petrol in 5 minutes. But, you know, what I often think, why am I in a rush? What is the rush? And the answer to that is almost always that I left it too late. You know, I'm always leaving things too late. I can't do anything about that. That's the very core of who I am as a human. I am incredibly bad at doing things. And when I do them, I'm in a rush. I'm not bad at doing them when I'm doing them, but I leave everything till the last minute. It causes all sorts of problems in your life when you do that. But I don't think you can... Can I be retrained? I don't know. Let's find out. I'm going to submit myself to a battery of unregulated scientific tests to determine whether or not the human brain can be reprogrammed to do things 4 weeks before they're needed rather than 3 minutes before the absolute last deadline.
We had a lot of listeners requesting that we talk about this next story. The BBC was one of many outlets that wrote that the UK is going to spend about £400 million on a stake in the failed satellite firm OneWeb as part of a plan to replace what it uses some of the EU's Galileo sat-nav system for. Now, OneWeb went bankrupt in March while trying to build a network of spacecraft that could deliver broadband around the world. And Business Secretary Alok Sharma said it would help deliver the first UK sovereign space capability.
Oh, God.
Hold that thought for the moment, because we need to expand on this a little bit. The UK is going to buy a large part of this bankrupt company OneWeb, 45% of it, in fact, according to my colleagues covering this week at Bloomberg, and another 45% will go to India's Bharti Enterprises. We'll include a link to all of these stories as well on uktechshow.com. Just check the show notes for episode 211. But we need to step back a little bit and remind ourselves what the EU's Galileo service does and why we need to replace it. Galileo is one of many global, well, not many, but a few global navigation systems that provide several services. These are things like your smartphone's mapping, of course, as well as some military function too. And it was created partly so that Europe wasn't beholden to using the US's GPS or the Russian GLONASS, isn't it? GLONASS, I think it's called, which are sort of the main two. But then obviously when the UK left Europe, we also lost access to certain important elements of Galileo. For consumers, this is less problematic because the devices that use the Galileo satellites, so that includes our phones, will continue to. It's open and there's chips built into the phones that just use Galileo. It's fine. So that won't be affected. And that's because they don't need to be quite as precise as they need to be for the military, nor do they need to use things like encryption. So for basically anyone listening to this, there's no need to worry. It's a non-event. It's not even really a consumer story. We're talking about it because we were asked to. And it is important, really. But for precise and encrypted location information, for stuff that's going to be used by the military and relied on by military for security stuff, things that can't be tampered with or rather can't be spoofed, Britain is going to get cut off. So we needed a replacement. OneWeb, simultaneous, this is in the big picture. OneWeb is a company that was founded in 2012. It's actually co-headquartered between London and California. It was created to launch hundreds of satellites into low Earth orbit and provide internet access to anyone, anywhere. It raised somewhere close to $2 billion, I think. But in March this year, it's ran out of money and an overwhelming majority of its staff were laid off and it went bankrupt. It only launched actually about 70 of the satellites into orbit out of a planned 650 or something. That's where our government got interested, because on the one hand, it said, well, we're running out of time to use the important Galileo stuff from the EU. And on the other hand, they're seeing this semi-British company going bankrupt but had a bunch of satellites in orbit. And so the genius idea was, why don't we spend nearly £500 million to buy this bankrupt company in order to use their satellites and their technology to replace what we're losing from Galileo? So that's what it did. Now on to the criticisms. One major bone of contention is that the kind of satellites used by OneWeb are too small and in too low an orbit. They're actually about 1,200 kilometers up. And to put that into context, that's about 20 times, almost 20 times closer to Earth than GPS or Galileo, which are about 20,000 kilometers up. And they're a hell of a lot smaller because the payloads that they have on board are not, they weren't designed to do what the GPS ones were designed to do. But like someone said, it basically seems like someone said, there's a bunch of satellites up there going cheap. Let's chuck some navigation stuff on there. And some experts have said that's naive and misguided and technically probably unfeasible. But if it works like the government seems to think it could, then it could turn out overall to be cheaper than developing and launching an entire replacement system from scratch and could be a great gamble. It just seems to have the odds stacked against them. So,
well,
that's the news, and Galileo will still be fine for our phones and our car GPSs and stuff like that. That's not what's being replaced. It is for military and secure applications because we won't have access to that from Galileo after the transition period ends.
Yeah, and I mean that is fair enough. I do think it's important because every time you see this reported on, it is very much written as, oh, the UK wants its own GPS system, and everyone's like, why? That doesn't make any sense. And you know, from a consumer perspective, they're absolutely right. It doesn't make any sense. When it comes to other applications, fair enough. The problem I think for us here is that we don't really know what the military applications are or what they require in order to function. I suppose part of me wants to just outright dismiss it and say that the government clearly is moronic, which they clearly are, but for different reasons, and that they have absolutely no logical way of making this work. But I have a feeling that perhaps there is something to this. They must have had some inclination or some information from advisors. I'm laughing in my head as I say that, that it was possible to make this into something useful. Otherwise, why spend £500 million on it? So it's extremely difficult to criticise if they know what they're doing. I think the argument would have to be that they almost certainly don't know what they're doing, and this will end up with another wasted £500 million going pretty much down the space shitter.
I'm inclined to agree with you that your devil's advocate voice, which is that to spend this amount of money on it, some clever people must have told some people in charge of budgets that actually this is a good idea. And I'm willing to give the benefit of the doubt because this is a company that's been around for 8 years. It has launched satellites successfully into orbit. Like there's knowledge. There are employees probably who'll have their jobs saved as part of this now as well. And it's not just the UK. You know, India will own basically half of this as well. So there's a potential for two entire governments and countries.
So I don't know how this qualifies as in quotes, sovereign British system, but I mean that's a stupid argument anyway that I've not bought into, so I'm all for it. I just laugh, you know. We're gonna do this Britain's gonna do this thing, yay, go Britain, with the help of the Indians, which is fine. But the whole point of this is, it just drives me insane. And I know we don't do politics, but we're inevitably going to have to at some point mention the fact this is stupid, and we could have just carried on paying for Galileo, which we've already paid for. So, you know, saying to the EU, OK, part of our exit deal is going to be that we are going to have access to Galileo. We'll continue to throw money into it as necessary. Why not just do that? It's absolutely stupid.
Because we can't have access to Galileo. It's not that we're just not going to have pay for
it. No, we could. If we negotiated it, we could have had it. They would have let us, I'm sure.
Part of what Galileo's advanced and precise technology can do is it can navigate down to the centimeter level as opposed to about a meter or something for GPS. It's like 100 by that measurement, it's about 100 times more accurate, which does make a big difference when you are targeting space lasers to annihilate things on behalf of a state-sanctioned murder order. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the fact is, like, we've told the EU that we don't want to use it because we don't want to be involved in anything super secure that we didn't develop. And we do.
But we did develop it. We provided experience and expertise, and we have some really good space scientists, don't we? We have a lot of satellite engineers in this country, and all of that would have been. And I remember there being a big discussion about this at the time, that, you know, we as a nation were extremely involved in Galileo, and it probably is going to be a success based on that. And I do completely understand the argument that we can't rely on things that not, you know, we're not part of anymore, but we could have continued to be part of it, as we could have been part of the, you know, we need to be part of the European Nuclear Agency, because we need to be able to get isotopes and we need to be able to do research, and that can be done much more effectively in a pan-European sense than it can be in a stupid island sense.
That's politics, and that's why we don't talk about it on this show normally.
That is true.
They are our thoughts on this. You are
1 hour 4 minutes for your cutting out of my swearing.
Yes.
Sorry.
It is political, but I like to think that we are a bubble. We talk about,
we are,
how did I exploit Andy when I was younger, and, you know, where are you going to take a dump off the Shetland Isles? That's normally what we talk about.
Yes,
but apparently this week we had something more important to talk about. But,
well, yeah,
if you have thoughts on any of this, of course you can send them to uktechshow@icloud.com.
You're used to hearing the smooth, velvet sound of Nate's voice drizzled over your ears like a warm eardrum syrup, topped off with the freshly squeezed citrus tang of an Ian Morris opinion. Supporters of the show at patreon.com/UKTech enjoy second helpings every week. So pull up a chair, find your nearest spoon, and tuck into a sumptuous extra helping with no commitment. If you have any allergies, please inform a waiter.
Well, let's hear what's been coming out of the mouth of Tom Merritt, who I'm sure is busy enjoying his 4th of July celebrations, but nonetheless prepared in advance to tell us what we've been missing this week on Daily Tech News Show.
This week on Daily Tech News Show, we celebrate the unilateral withdrawal of the colonies from the kingdom on Friday, so no show. But the rest of the week includes why Facebook won't lose money due to the ad boycott, the state of the decentralized internet, Discord's pivot away from gaming, and a new and improved way to face swap in video from Disney. All that and much more as we head into Security Week at DailyTechNewsShow.com.
Ian, it's been a delight to be spending this time with you, as it always is at this time.
Yes.
On a Sunday. Is the feeling mutual?
Of course it's mutual.
Good.
It's great. We have a nice chat. I usually start feeling a bit dozy, and by the end, I feel like I've been invigorated and my lust for life has returned.
Good. If there's nothing more than I like ingesting, like just putting lust into you in a day.
Well, consider me lustified.
Excellent. I'm feeling very lustful as well. And thank you to our patrons, of course, especially those today listening to us live. We've got a whole bunch of people live. We've got Andy, we've got John, KV, Mike, we've got Pangolin Sandwich, we've got Richard Taylor. It's been a wonderful afternoon, and I'm feeling, well, lustful now. Thank you, Ian.
And we've done actual radio, you might argue. If we'd been given a slot on Radio 1, I mean, that would have been fairly entertaining for a percentage of the audience. I do wish someone would give me a radio show. I mean, it's not that I feel particularly confident about running a radio show, but I do love radio. I would love to work in radio.
Yeah.
I was thinking the other day about how nice it would be to live for 400 years just so you could do like four distinct careers.
Yeah.
You know, start with one, have a go at another. That would be wonderful.
Goodbye, everybody.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.